Good evening and welcome to our recent advances in cancer care, new paradigms, novel agents, and what it means for the oncology nurse. We're going to be talking about bladder cancer this evening, so welcome everyone. My name's Terry Friedlander. I'm a medical oncologist at the University of California in San Francisco. It's my great pleasure to be moderating today. We have a really excellent panel today going from far side of the stage. We have Dr. Alexandra Dracacki, who's a good friend of mine and a colleague at the University of California, Los Angeles. Go UC. And she is an associate professor there as well and directs the medical, the genitourinary oncology program. Next to her, we have Rita Huber, who's a nurse practitioner, also focusing on GU malignancies at Stanford Healthcare, and she also works at Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital alongside me, so it's great to have you, Rita. And last but not least, we have Christina Amodi, who's also a nurse practitioner at University of California, San Francisco. She's on the surgical side. She also leads our bladder cancer survivorship program and is a fierce advocate for the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network, which is a really great organization promoting better health outcomes in bladder cancer. Here are our conflicts of interests. I'll just go through these pretty quickly. Here's our commercial support for the program today. Research to Practice, the CME Planning Committee, staff and reviewers have no conflict of interest to disclose. The program is going to contain discussions of non-approved, or may contain discussions of non-approved uses of agents and regimens, so please refer to the official prescribing information for each product and the approved indications. The educational items, themes, I should say, of all 11 programs focus on the integration of new agents, regimens, and therapies into oncology practice, when they should be used, for whom, and why, as well as how to prevent and manage associated side effects. So with that, this is where we're headed today. We'll start out with the basic biology of non-metastatic urothelial bladder cancer, so localized disease, what we're going to focus on today. Then we'll talk about systemic therapy for cisplatin-eligible patients, followed with MIBC, followed by the evolving approach to systemic therapy for cisplatin-ineligible patients with MIBC. And then we'll focus at the bottom on immune checkpoint inhibitors and non-muscle invasive bladder cancer and finish out with a discussion on novel intravesical therapies. So with that, I'm going to turn the stage over to Christina, who's going to talk to us about the basic biology of non-metastatic urothelial bladder cancer.
Thank you, Terry. Hi, everyone. Good evening. Very fortunate to be here and talk to you about bladder cancer. The few things we will be addressing today is really understanding the difference between metastatic or muscle invasive versus localized non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, the role of various treatments, and historically what has been employed. How are we educating our patients? And as a nurse, what is it that you should be really focusing on, including during intravesical therapy and along what we need to focus on during radical cystectomy when the bladder is removed? And I will be tying this together with a case study to make a little bit more sense out of it. Bladder cancer is a very complex cancer. It is a lifelong cancer, and it's probably the most expensive cancer that we are currently treating. It requires lifelong surveillance and monitoring. Important to understand how bladder cancer is staged, and the staging really depends on which layer of the urothelium the cancer cells invade. So when we are talking the urothelium from the top to the bottom, flat, high-grade or low-grade cancers basically lie in the urothelium. Some papillary tumors grow out like an appendage. And these are non-invasive cancers. However, carcinoma in situ on the top is actually high-grade, requiring fairly complex treatment. When we have the first layer invade, which is called the lamina propria, this is where we start going into high-grade T1 treatments, where you are now utilizing a lot of nursing care and urology care, because these are the folks generally who require intravesical therapy along with BCG or other modalities, plus the folks with carcinoma in situ. The first distinctive factor for muscle invasion is when we invade the second layer, which is the muscle, and that is your T2 bladder cancer, requiring generally neoadjuvant systemic therapy, followed by usually cystectomy. Currently, the AUA guidelines guide a lot of our decision making. This is a busy slide, but the bottom of, most importantly, we have low, intermediate, or high-grade disease. Whether something gets a particular classification depends on the site of the tumor, whether it's a solitary or multifocal, depending on what it invades, and whether or not carcinoma in situ, again, is a major deal breaker in these situations, which automatically gets a high-grade classification. Three things you need to remember when your patient walks in with hematuria, whether that is primary care or specialty care. These are your three C's, leading every single workup from the beginning, which is your cystoscopy, urine cytology, and CT urography. A CT urogram is not identical to a CT abdomen pelvis. I cannot overemphasize this because a CT urogram is highly specific with a delayed sequence of views that the radiologist will sequence so we can actually monitor upper tract. Upper tract is your two kidneys and two ureters, and the lining of those structures are very important for development of upper tract disease. For us to actually visualize the bladder, it requires cystoscopy, which is a little scope with a camera at the end. The urologist or the advanced practice provider will advance the camera and the scope through the urethra so we can actually visualize the bladder. The sensitivity, meaning a test picking up a true positive, is not very good for small bladder masses with CT urogram. And the third piece of the puzzle is actually your cytology. Cytology is a urine test, and the pathologist will look at the test under the microscope, needs to have a very specific interpretation for high-grade abnormal cells. So we're not getting a cancer diagnosis here, but we're actually getting a distinction for high-grade or abnormality. Now, my patient is Mark, who is 54. Mark has a really good functional status. He has two small children who are 12 years old and former smoker, which is by far the biggest risk factor for developing bladder cancer or urothelial cancers, even though he quit 20-some years ago. No chemical exposures. His mother had bladder cancer, and his partner has died of leukemia. So he's basically a single father of two 12-year-old twins with a very good, highly functioning life. Mark presented with gross hematuria and had the proper workup that I mentioned previously with abnormal urine cytology, which is classified on a very specific system. CT urogram showed a mass, and we had abnormal cystoscopy findings. These results were congruent. Now, what's next? For bladder cancer, the surgeon takes the patient to the operating room, and we basically have to scrape the bladder to identify the degree of invasion, which is that same slide that I presented before. And Mark had high-grade T1 along with high-grade TA. So TA is non-invasive, flat. However, high-grade T1 invades the lamina propria. Unfortunately, my picture covers some of the words here, but when a neuropathology says that muscle is present uninvolved, this is a very important point for staging your patients. It means that the surgeon's needle has gone into the muscle layer, and in that layer, we have not found cancer. Once the patient has their procedure, we are basically waiting approximately 3 to 4 weeks. Reason being, A, we need to be sure that cancer is not regrowing, and two, we need to be sure that the staging is correct. There's approximately a 20 to 30% upstaging from T1 to T2. Some of these cancers are not visible under office white light cystoscopy. So in this case, we actually utilized a special blue light cystoscopy where nursing is highly important to install these into the bladder an hour prior to procedure. So under UV light, flat high-grade tumors like CIS in this case is actually lit up. BCG is indicated and a gold standard treatment for high-grade treatments. As you can see on this slide, it is a very complex, very involved induction and maintenance cycles up to 3 years. This is, again, heavily nursing dependent in the infusion center. You guys are managing these patients constantly with installations, and the installations are potentially painful the further down we go into this journey. So this slide is just an indication that this gentleman has started the BCG induction cycles, and we went down 2.5 years of treatment, which is a lot of installations and a lot of management of dysuria, infections, etc. Now, at the end of treatment, we still found a 5-millimeter left-sided bladder lesion, basically requiring a conversation, which my colleagues will address here in a little bit, what additional treatments are available for patients who have failed BCG, which is currently the most effective gold standard treatment, and they would like to have bladder preservation. So we are going to talk about additional systemic or intravesical therapies that are currently available. However, up until recently, the gold standard for high-grade BCG failure was radical cystectomy. Radical cystectomy in this patient is important for disease control. He's young, he's otherwise highly functional, he has 2 small children, and the goal of these surgeries is to basically have a full cure rate at 95%. As for Mark, he did end up choosing this route. A lot of education goes into the pre-op preparation of these patients with ostomy nursing, with clinic pre-op preparations, and post-op management is heavily relying on both your nursing and your APP team, along with survivorship management. Now, the difference in his case, although, again, we didn't find any muscle invasion, prior to EV Pembro, we were looking at patients with cisplatin eligibility managed strictly by medical oncology, not surgical oncology. And these criteria are not used much longer anymore in the area of EV Pembro. However, up until even 2 years ago, all of our patients were really struggling finishing treatment, having cisplatin nephrotoxicity or other functional problems. So when I'm looking at Mark and how we have affected his life in a holistic way, I think at the end of the day, from a nursing perspective, we want you to live a full life. We want you to live well, travel well, and not have any restrictions on what you are doing. As far as diversions, many of you are familiar. Most institutions offer either neobladders, Indiana pouches, or conduits. Given his high functional status, we went with a neobladder, which is probably one of the more complicated diversions. However, long-term works really well. As far as nursing interventions, I think it has been data-driven and shown that highly specialized nursing care in urology actually prevents complications. You guys are the one in the infusion center or on the ground to pick up the signs and symptoms of any toxicities or any issues and can prevent an admission or problems arising probably 3 days ahead of time. I cannot overemphasize the lack of enough ostomy nursing, wound and ostomy, that goes into the field, and it is left, right, and center post-cystectomy managing these patients. Sexual health, once this patient had their bladder removed, we are talking about a radical prostatectomy along with sexual dysfunction, so that's a whole different talk in itself, and with that being said, I am passing down the torch.
Great. Thank you, Christina. That is a really comprehensive overview of a big topic, non-muscle invasive, muscle invasive disease, the role of BCG, the role of cystectomy. Patients get a lot of treatment here. They end up in the infusion center, as you said, getting a lot of therapy. I think what we're going to do is pivot and talk about perioperative therapy. So if we have a patient who's going for cystectomy like Mark, are there things we can do that improve outcomes like systemic therapy? And so Dr. Jakaki is going to talk to us about that. So take it away, Alexandra.
Thank you so much. Thank you for the invitation to be here, and it's wonderful to be among all of you and many of our nurses from UCLA who are actually taking care of my patients every day. So, as you already heard, patients have bladder cancer, but the patients really don't know what bladder cancer means, right? They come to us, and we have to guide them. Is it early stage? Is it advanced stage? And this is critical because the survival is significantly better when it's just on the surface, when people seek care early on, versus when it's more advanced. But thankfully, there's progress. So to this day, we still talk about cisplatin eligibility, and this is how we design our initial clinical trials. But thankfully, the field is changing. So now we have newer drugs, and we actually start deviating from this eligibility aspect of things. So we have 3 and soon 4th to be presented in upcoming meetings, neoadjuvant perioperative studies. So we have the Niagara, the EV-303, EV-304, and again soon the Volga. So the Niagara is actually the first global phase 3 study that studied patients who are cisplatin ineligible. And actually, we had 1,000 patients randomized to two groups. Group one was the standard of care cisplatin gemcitabine, and the study arm was cisplatin gemcitabine durvalumab, the PD-L1 inhibitor. Patients after 4 cycles in the neoadjuvant setting underwent cystectomy, and then in the adjuvant, they received durvalumab in the study arm, and there was no treatment in the control arm. Now, I would like to remind everybody that this study was designed and conducted before adjuvant immunotherapy was approved. And even if it was approved in the United States, there were all the other countries around the globe that they did not have adjuvant nivo either approved or available. And so this was a true study understanding how the durvalumab in this perioperative setting improved outcomes in this patient population. So that is now level one evidence in the NCCN guidelines. And what we learned is that actually the durvalumab provides a 10% improvement in the pathologic complete response rate. And there is also a significant improvement in event-free survival and overall survival in our patients that are cisplatin eligible. It's important also to talk about what is happening in real life. So patients with bladder cancer, at least in this country, tend to be older, tend to have already other comorbidities and borderline kidney function. So what was really unique in the Niagara design is that it allowed patients with borderline kidney function with a creatinine clearance between 40 and 60 to be actually allowed to participate. And in these patients, we give a split dose of cisplatin, so the 35 milligram per mL square on day 1 and 8. And what was also interesting is that we see an even more significant improvement in the pathologic complete response in that subgroup of patients that had borderline kidney function. And then the other piece is, you know, we talk about bladder cancer, but it's not really one disease. The majority have urothelial cancer or urothelial subtype, but we do see nested ovarian, micropapillary, squamous features. So in the Niagara, there was a small percent of patients that had this mixed histology, and they were still allowed to participate. So again, we were able to see improvement by adding durvalumab, and this is the study that made to the New England Journal of Medicine and was one of the first FDA approvals for this patient population. Now, the second big study that was, again, recently presented is the KEYNOTE-B15 or EV-304. So the patient population was exactly the same. So were patients that they were cisplatin eligible. And what we studied was, should they get cisplatin gemcitabine or should they get enfortumab vedotin with pembrolizumab? So enfortumab vedotin is a drug that we'll be discussing a lot today because it's a novel agent. It's an antibody drug conjugate that basically delivers the drug into the Nectin-4 expressing cells. And those cells tend to be in the urothelial cancers and in our skin. So we'll talk a lot about the skin toxicity, but just for you to understand what were the drugs that we offered in patients in the B15 trial. So patients received 4 cycles in the neoadjuvant setting, again, either study arm or control arm, and then after surgery, underwent adjuvant therapy with enfortumab vedotin and pembrolizumab or observation. Again, the same issue applies with the observation aspect. The study was amended and allowed adjuvant nivolumab in the countries that was available. So what we learn is that there is, again, a significant improvement in the pathologic complete response, event-free survival, and overall survival in the EVP arm compared to the standard of care cisplatin gemcitabine. Similarly, which also was interesting, they allowed patients with creatinine clearance even between 60 to 90, but also 30 to 60, so that they went a little bit more broad compared to the Niagara, and they allowed patients with T2 disease. Now, an important point to make is that 50% of the patients did not receive adjuvant therapy in the study arm. They did not receive the EV pembrolizumab, primarily because of toxicity, which is, again, real-life issues. So looking at our NCCN guidelines, other than our traditional platinum-based chemotherapy, now we do have our Niagara regimen as category one, and EVP is joining as level two evidence. So going over a patient that we're seeing in clinic, this is a young lady, 48 years old. I used to think 48 is old, but actually it's not that old. We're getting there. So this lady has four kids, had two pairs of twins. So it was very normal for her as time was going on to have some pelvic pressure and some stress incontinence. And at some point was having some hematuria. And so she saw her OBGYN to see, is it really OBGYN related? But unfortunately, time tell that she has a huge bladder mass. So underwent the URBT, so to have a high-grade urothelial cancer with micropapillary features. And so she had the T3N0M0 disease, and she was referred to us. It was always interesting to go over the family history because there are some syndromes like Lynch syndrome, where patient families have cancers. So in this case, her mom had ovarian, her brother had prostate. So we know that actually immunotherapy tends to be very effective in this patient population. And given that she's, again, a young lady with young kids, she wanted everything to be done. So underwent through the Niagara regimen. She received this platinum, gemcitabine, and durvalumab. Had pretty good tolerance throughout the treatment and pretty good response. So she had a pathologic T1 disease with some CAS and negative margins. And upon completion of the 8 cycles of durvalumab in the adjuvant setting, she remains cancer-free.
Great. So that's a fantastic example of how we've really improved outcomes for patients with muscle-invasive bladder cancer. And really, these studies have shown that adding immune therapy to standard chemotherapy, platinum chemotherapy, which we've had for many years, mm-hmm. or adding enfortumab vedotin, which is this new antibody drug conjugate with immunotherapy, is really improving outcomes. We're saving lives. We're preventing cancer from coming back. I guess, Dr. Jakaki, so we have these two regimens you've just talked about, platinum plus durvalumab, or enfortumab vedotin plus pembro, is one better than the other? And if both were approved, because they're currently pending FDA approval for the EV regimen, how do you counsel a patient, and what should nurses know about that?
Okay, thank you for asking this question. I didn't expect to put me on the spot. Uh-huh. This is what we hear and talk with patients and colleagues all the time. So the way that I see this is really the side effect profile. While immunotherapy is in both regimens, we know that patients with enfortumab vedotin need to have very good controlled glucose and diabetes or pre-diabetes, because that adds up to the risk of neuropathy and the risk of hyperglycemia as a result of the treatment itself. At the same time, cisplatin, we know that it can cause hearing compromise and neuropathy and kidney dysfunction. So we really try to tell the patient that, you know, nothing comes as a free meal. You're going to have side effects. It's a matter of which of those are most important to you.
Okay, so I think that it really does come down to sort of evaluating each patient individually. And I think one of the take-home points is we really have to know our patients well, right? If they already are wearing hearing aids, they probably shouldn't get cisplatin. Actually, Christina just covered that in her talk. On the flip side, if they have really bad neuropathy, both of these agents cause neuropathy, and we may not give them either agent, you might just take them right to surgery. So I think like really getting a good history from the patient is incredibly important, and then guiding them through therapy. I think in the interest of time, we're going to move on to Rita's talk. Rita's going to be talking to us about the tolerability of immune checkpoint inhibitors in urothelial bladder cancer. So take it away, Rita.
Thank you for being here. I know it's been a long day for many of you, probably traveling and learning a lot, but I will try not to put you to sleep. My portion is going to be covering drugs in bladder cancer, and we are going to start with immune checkpoint inhibitors. And first, we're going to look at mechanism of action. I think it helps us to understand also how the drugs work and then the side effects based on it. So how do these drugs work? They work by blocking the special interaction between PD-1 receptor on the T cell and PD-L1 signal on the tumor cell. Normally, this interaction turns the immune system off, and then the immune system cannot fight the cancer. But by blocking this connection, the T cell stays active and can go and attack cancer. That all sounds incredible, but the biggest challenge here is that when the immune system is overreactive, we can see a lot of autoimmune side effects related to it. This is a very busy slide, but I will try to walk everyone through this. We'll talk about side effects. Essentially, immunotherapy can affect any organ in our body. Think of any condition that ends at itis. Pneumonitis, colitis, hepatitis, thyroiditis, anything that itis can happen. And luckily, generally, immune-mediated side effects follow a specific timing pattern. We see in the beginning skin toxicities, heart, endocrine, liver toxicities, GI can happen a little earlier on, and the pulmonary renal occur a little bit later on. But still very important to remember here that at any time, any organ can be affected. And if your patient have a side effects related to therapy, consider that this could be related to the treatment. Before we start treatment, we carefully monitor our patients with baseline assessment. We do some labs assessment. We also screen them for any autoimmune conditions because in some cases, immunotherapy can exacerbate those conditions. When patients are receiving treatment, of course, we check their labs regularly, do assessments, and ask about any symptoms. Toxicities are usually managed by grade or severity. So for grade 1 or mild toxicities, usually patients can continue treatment, and we just continue to maybe some supportive measures. The exceptions here are serious toxicities related to heart, cardiac toxicities like myocarditis, and neurologic toxicities like myasthenia gravis or Guillain-Barré syndrome. If you have a suspicion the patient has that toxicity, we need to hold immune checkpoint inhibitor and start them on high-dose steroids. For grade 2 or moderate toxicities, we usually have to hold the treatment and start patients on high-dose steroids. And also, oftentimes, we have to refer them to specialty care. Again, there is one exception here as well. Endocrine toxicities like thyroiditis, we don't manage the steroids. We do hormone replacement for those patients. For more severe or grade 3 toxicities and grade 4 toxicities, a lot of times patients need to be admitted to the hospital because they require IV high-dose steroids. And, of course, multidisciplinary management. Some of these patients may be able to taper off steroids and improve fairly quickly, but others may require permanent discontinuation of immunotherapy. The big thing that I wanted to highlight here is how important it is to recognize these side effects very early, and I think it really can change our patients' outcome because of that. We need to focus on asking patients about any new symptoms related to their compared to their baseline. For example, any new shortness of breath, jaundice, any watery diarrhea, any new weakness, polyuria, polydipsia. And wanted to highlight here a few conditions, specifically pneumonitis and neurologic toxicities, and as well as myocarditis. These are one of the most dangerous ones, and we always need to be very vigilant and ask our patients if they have any of those symptoms. And just the final takeaways about toxicities from immune checkpoint inhibitors is remember any organ can be affected by immunotherapy. We need to monitor our patients very closely. We always treat cardiac and neurologic toxicities very aggressively. And most of the toxicities, severe toxicities, we manage the steroids. Exception is here endocrine toxicities. We do hormone replacement. And now we're going to look at the case. Okay, so we have our DS. He's a 71-year-old gentleman who is a retired long-haul trucker. He used to smoke. He has a history of a mild COPD and high blood pressure and also renal insufficiency. He cannot get cisplatin chemotherapy because of that. So he was diagnosed with muscle-invasive bladder cancer and was recommended that he's going to get 3 cycles perioperatively with EV and pembrolizumab. And then proceed to cystectomy. Our Oh, and I forgot to mention also, Diaz has a very supportive daughter who really helps him, and she's a nurse, so she really is on top of his care. Diaz gets two cycles of treatment, and his daughter is very concerned. She's calling us with a few symptoms. They're seemingly not really related to each other, but she's very panicked. She says that his eyelids are very droopy. He cannot open his eyes. He has difficulty swallowing pills. He has some worsening weakness, and he also has chest discomfort, but he says it's just a heartburn. Individually, some of these could be very vague, especially in our older patient population, but altogether, they're a major red flag here. Infusion center clinical team was very concerned, and they sent our patient to the emergency room for evaluation. He was diagnosed with something called triple M syndrome. It is a very rare but potentially very life-threatening condition, combining myocarditis, myositis, and myasthenia gravis. Myocarditis is inflammation of the heart muscle, and patients may present with elevated troponin. They may have some chest pain, arrhythmias on EKG. Myositis is inflammation of muscles. Their CKA may be elevated. They may have weakness and kind of could be non-specific symptoms as well. Myasthenia gravis here is also another neurological, very dangerous side effects. What happens is the nerves cannot communicate with muscles, and we see this slow muscular degeneration. First, patients may present the droopy eyes, and then they have trouble swallowing pills, and then it could actually progress to respiratory failure. So what happened for our patient? We permanently discontinued pembrolizumab because this is a very severe adverse event. He was started on high-dose steroids. He received IVIG. This patient was admitted to ICU care because he required a very high level of care. Eventually, he was transferred to the floor. His steroids were very, very slowly tapered off, and he was discharged home. Luckily, this patient made full recovery. He was able to proceed the surgery, and he got what we call pathologic complete response, meaning that all cancer was gone on his pathology. In this case, I just wanted to highlight very quickly that majority of our patients that we see in our practice maybe may have some only mild side effects from immunotherapy, but there is potential for these very severe cases, and we need to be very vigilant. In my own clinical practice, I've seen this twice, unfortunately, and one outcome was fatal, even though we very aggressively managed the patient. And the other case, patient reported symptoms very early, and we were able to start steroids, and he made full recovery.
Great. Thanks so much, Rita. That's a really comprehensive talk, and I think it's just important to highlight how important it is to take the patient's history and what they're saying seriously, because there's so many of these autoimmune side effects. I guess one question you can see on the slide here is, when you're talking to patients, how frequently do they experience these side effects? What do you tell them, both for mild and then for the really severe ones?
I would say the mild side effects, a majority of the patients tolerate these infusions really well and have almost no side effects. Mild side effects probably present in about 40% of patients, and severe and life-threatening maybe 5 to 15% of patients.
Yeah, that's been my observation. I imagine Alexandra similar. Yeah,
that is correct. And sometimes I try to encourage them and say, well, we do want some side effects because that tells us that the drug is doing what it's supposed to do. But as Rita mentioned, the key is reporting to us. And oftentimes it's our nurses who will call us because actually they get the labs first and they say, you know what, something doesn't seem right with the liver or with the kidney function. And that's why we depend on our nurses. But the key is communication.
Yeah, I 100% agree. It's really recognizing this early, intervening early. So I'm going to we're going to move on and talk about cell-free or circulating tumor DNA, and I'm going to go through this a little quickly. This is a new avenue, a new way to assess cancer and assess the disease that uses a liquid biopsy. So basically, first the tumor is taken, the tumor is analyzed for genetic mutations, later on blood is taken, and they can identify those mutations in the blood. And it's been very clearly shown that people who have detectable circulating tumor DNA have a worse prognosis. It's like a PSA, it's like a surrogate for having some cancer circulating in the body. And this study is really important because this was one of the first studies to base treatment on the presence or absence of circulating tumor DNA. And so this study is called IMvigor011. And basically it took patients who were getting their bladders removed, and the study started after they had their bladder out. You can see that on the slide here. The patients enrolled, and then they got their blood tested for presence or absence of cell-free DNA. If they didn't have it, that's the bottom of this slide, they were just monitored. But they were watched for a whole year, and they got their blood tested, I think, every 6 weeks or so to see if there was cell-free DNA. And if they became positive, then they were randomized to either get atezolizumab, a PD-L1 inhibitor, or just to get a placebo. And the question was, does treating the patients who were positive, does that benefit them? And the answer is yes. This was the data that was presented just recently. And you can see the blue line, the patients who got treated did much better than patients who didn't get treated. So if we see a positive ctDNA result, that's a bad sign. It means the cancer is very likely to come back. That red line almost hits the bottom, meaning almost everybody relapses. And giving therapy is beneficial. You can see that also in terms of overall survival. The patients who got earlier immune therapy did better. And so this was the author's conclusions, which was that giving treatment to people who have positive cell-free DNA is a good idea. And I think you're going to start seeing this more and more, where patients are getting cell-free DNA, and you guys may be the first line, you know, of seeing these results. And so I think if you see a positive cell-free DNA, that's a really bad sign, and I think it merits a big multidisciplinary discussion about what to do for that patient. And then this is going to be embedded in just about every trial in bladder cancer going forward, and may eventually like be a substitute for doing scans and things like that, because it's that sensitive. But we obviously need to test that. So this is an exciting new development in bladder cancer. I think in the interest of time, I'm going to move past the discussion questions, and we're actually going to go on to module two to talk about cisplatin-ineligible patients with MIBC. So this is Dr. Drakaki's take it away, please. Thanks.
Thank you so much. So since we have also new nurses joining the field, I would like to kind of remind you, which is very impressive. So the guidelines between ASCO, ASTRO, the Radiation Oncology, and EAU back in 2016 said that patients who cannot receive cisplatin, so if they have poor kidney function, neuropathy, hearing issues, and so on, they should actually go for surgery. And if there are trials, and I have to say back in 2016, there were not many trials for cis-ineligible patients. So it's great to see that finally there's change in the field. So we have two major phase 3 trials for cisplatin-ineligible patients, the KEYNOTE-905 or 303, and the Volga. I have the illustration again, just because I like colors and graphs, and I try to put green so I can match with the slides. So you can see the enfortumab vedotin is exactly kind of as a magnet, the drug gets into the Nectin-4 expressing cells. And the graph next to it is how ADCs and immunotherapy work together. So the ADC kills the cancer cells, new antigens get released, and then immunotherapy takes over, and there is even more significant activation of the immune system. So taking that in consideration now makes sense why the trials were designed as such. So patients with the 905 trial got EV with Pembro or Pembro alone, and this is where you try to understand, do you need just one drug, do you need two drugs? And the arm three was observation. Now, there was a lot of stress in the clinic because patients said, well, if you tell me that I need to get neoadjuvant therapy, why are you going to put me on a study that actually I'll have to go for surgery directly? So this is what observation meant. Like, you're randomized, you go for surgery. And truthfully, it was the request from the FDA. They said, if cis ineligible should have surgery, you need to have an arm testing that. So patients in that study after radical cystectomy continued in the adjuvant portion with either single agent Pembro or Pembro EV Oregon observation. Well, the Volga trial had a little bit tweaks into this concept, and the study was durvalumab plus tremelimumab, the CTLA-4 agent, plus enfortumab vedotin for 3 cycles, or durvalumab and enfortumab vedotin. Again, same question. Do we need 2 immune checkpoint inhibitors, or 1 is enough? And again, arm 3 was, by the request of FDA, just direct cystectomy, followed by either a dose of tremelimumab with durvalumab, and for those that have used CTLA-4 inhibitors in other disease entities, like the Nivo-Ipi combinations, we know that the CTLA-4 tends to cause more toxicity. So the smart design on this durva-trem-EV arm is that there was only 3 cycles of CTLA-4, 2 before, 1 after. And the concept of the 1 after is, again, to reawake up the immune system to attack any leftover cancer cells. And that's where ctDNA is critical, because you have a way to monitor, are there cancer cells? The durva-EV arm continued with only durva. And then the observation was either observation of or nivolumab, again, for the countries that was approved. Now, first, I'll talk about the 303 trial, because this is what was presented very recently at ESMO. And they analyzed only the 2 arms, the EV Pembro compared to surgery alone. The third arm of Pembro before and after has not been reported yet. So the patient characteristics, again, since it was cis-ineligible population, the creatinine clearance was between 30 and 60. And they allowed 1 patient with less than 30. They allowed patients with T2 disease, and the pure urothelial was around 90% in both arms, which means 10% of patients had also mixed histology, which, again, it's very helpful to know how these patients are doing. And it was truly, truly impressive. It happened that I was at the meeting at the time of the presentation, and it was a true standing ovation when the colleague presented the data and showed the significant difference when you give EV Pembro versus just surgery. So the pathologic complete response was almost 60%. Again, very, very important improvement in event-free survival and overall survival. And of course, when we analyze this, when you don't do anything, if you don't do systemic therapy, you expect that patients are not going to do well. So it's another actually way to try to explain patients, you need systemic therapy. Nobody wants side effects, but, you know, it's about your life. We know if you are not treated, the chance of dying is high. Now, I already described the Volga trial. It's, again, another illustration, and it's very timely that the talk is today, because a few hours ago, we got the press release, and the Volga trial is actually a positive study. I'm saying that and I have chills because, you know, it's truly my baby. It really, really means a lot. There are like more than 200 sites around the world. And, you know, changing how you treat this disease is so meaningful. So we're going to hear more in upcoming meetings. But again, it's very, very important how we all work together and we try to change how we treat patients with cis-ineligible muscle-invasive bladder cancer. So here I will discuss about another gentleman that has a disease. So this patient was having chronic back pain and flank pain, and he was just ignoring it. He thought it was just working out, and it's true that in LA people work out a lot. So he was postponing to go to see the doctor, but then eventually he reached the attention. And as you see here, he had a significant mass, and that mass was causing significant left-sided hydronephrosis. So this back pain was because of that poor left kidney that was so congested. He had, interesting family history, mom with uterine cancer, brother with prostate cancer. Again, it's always a red flag, is that Lynch syndrome. And the other piece is that he was a hairdresser. So I know your patient was a truck driver. So all these are like risk factors for urothelial cancer. We know hair dye increase the risk. Otherwise, he was pretty healthy. And so he had the luck to get through the EV Pembro study. because his creatinine clearance was also compromised, which is not a surprise, with left-sided hydronephrosis. He was able to get through the whole year of treatment, and 3 years later, he remains cancer-free.
Wonderful. So we heard sort of another case of perioperative therapy, and this is a success story because the patient's cancer-free. Now, this is an approved regimen for cisplatin-ineligible patients, giving EV and Pembro together. I guess, Alexander, are there any patients who you don't recommend get this regimen? Or is this really, if we have a patient who's cisplatin-ineligible, is this like one size fits all for everybody?
You know, it's hard to not to offer this. I guess it's the same conversation like earlier. You want to make sure you optimize their health. I have to say, this new era of the GLP drugs, that everybody wants to take them, not because they are diabetic, just because they want to look good in their swimming suit. I have to say, these drugs have improved the hyperglycemia and have improved their neuropathy. And so my sense is, you know, do no harm. So I will offer the regimen, but I will make sure I point out that you need to be, again, mindful and report everything. This eyelid droop has been, again, I had 3 patients with triple M, and thank God, thanks to telemedicine, we're able to diagnose them by just looking at them on the camera. So, you know, you don't want to cure someone from their cancer and kill them with toxicity. So, you know, that's always a struggle.
Yeah, so I think that's very helpful. So it does seem like this enfortumab vedotin and pembrolizumab regimen is really here to stay. This is going to be used for almost all of our perioperative patients unless they have contraindications. And actually, this is a great segue for Rita, who's going to talk to us about the side effects of EV, and specifically, and I think this is incredibly important for nursing, who not to give this therapy to. If the patient's sitting in your chair, the doctor's ordered it, what should you be looking for to say, hold on, this is unsafe? And so Rita, I'm hoping we can hear that from you. Let's take it away.
I'll be happy to talk about EV a little bit. We hear a full name, enfortumab vedotin, but we're just going to call it EV because nobody wants to say this long word. So it's mentioned that it's antibody drug conjugate, but what does it mean? Think of EV as a smart missile. It targets the special protein Nectin-4, which has already been mentioned, and it is presented. It's present on the bladder cells. And it's able to deliver chemotherapy directly into that bladder cancer cells and cause cell death. So it doesn't go throughout the body like a traditional chemotherapy. But this Nectin-4 is also present in our skin and peripheral nerves. That's why we see some skin toxicities and neuropathy with this drug. Skin reaction very common and even happened right after first infusion when patients walk out of infusion center. Next day, they can already have some rash. Then we see neuropathy. It's usually cumulative. It happens later on. Doesn't happen right away after first infusion. High blood sugar is also pretty common. And also eye toxicity is usually pretty mild, just dry eyes and some irritation. And of course, we see other things like fatigue, alopecia, elevated LFTs, and nausea also as well. Because EV is given together with pembrolizumab, sometimes it's hard to identify which one is causing what. And here I wanted to point out that toxicities from EV are generally more predictable. Like I mentioned, skin, neuropathy, hyperglycemia, eye toxicities. Toxicities with immunotherapy are a little more tricky, and they can be also more severe and present very acutely. And I wanted to highlight here, one of the things is hyperglycemia with EV usually will be more gradual. And if we see sudden onset, very severe hyperglycemia, patient could be developing type 1 autoimmune diabetes from pembrolizumab. So the management of skin toxicities, I will quickly cover that. Basically, for grade 1 or mild skin toxicities, we just use topical corticosteroids and some supportive care, antihistamines. For more moderate toxicities, we may need to pause treatment and sometimes escalate to oral steroids and refer them to dermatology. EV does have a black box warning, meaning that there are some patients that could develop very severe skin toxicities, like Stevens-Johnson syndrome or toxic epidermal necrolysis. This is life-threatening and dangerous. Those patients need to be admitted to the hospital, a lot of times burn unit or ICU. They may present to your clinic with some blistering, skin is peeling, they may have some mucous membrane involvement. Specifically, you know, educate your patients about this. This is something not to miss. Peripheral neuropathy, again, usually cumulative. When it starts affecting function, we need to hold the treatment, and a lot of times we need to dose reduce. Unfortunately, neuropathy in many cases is irreversible. So very important to recognize this early and try to intervene. So hyperglycemia, also very common. This is why we check hemoglobin A1C before we start EV, and also we monitor blood sugars prior to each cycle. If their blood glucose raises over 250, we need to hold treatment until we optimize blood sugar. And we need to educate our patients about DKA symptoms like polyuria, polydipsia, if they have any nausea or any confusion. Eye toxicities, usually pretty mild. Most of the patients have some mild irritation or dry eyes. I usually recommend my patients using artificial tears, and it usually greatly help to reduce some of these side effects. If a patient presents to your clinic with severe eye pain or photophobia, that could be related to pembrolizumab, and they may be developing uveitis. In those cases, we need to hold the drug and refer them to ophthalmology. The key points from EV toxicity, more predictable pattern compared to immune checkpoint inhibitors. Again, also important to recognize early, especially in irreversible toxicities like neuropathy. And of course, it helps our patients to stay on these drugs and also avoid any delays. And we are going to look at the case. We have another patient who is MK. He's a 65-year-old gentleman. He's a self-employed electrician, and it's very important for him to use his hands. He has muscle-invasive bladder cancer. Again, he cannot receive cisplatin chemotherapy because of his kidney function, and the plan is to give him EV and pembrolizumab and proceed with radical cystectomy. And the plan to give him 3 cycles total prior to surgery. Another thing here that I wanted to note is that his circulating tumor DNA is 1.8, which is positive. And we already know a lot about circulating tumor DNA. So this patient gets treatment, and after cycle 1, he gets a mild rush. We prescribe him topical triamcinolone, and it goes away. But unfortunately, after cycle number 2, he develops neuropathy, and he tells us that now he's dropping tools at work. He cannot really fulfill his duties. And we have a big dilemma here. Should we try to give him more EV and maximize chances for cure, or should we stop now and prevent this irreversible toxicity? So what in this case we did, we tested his ctDNA, and previously was positive, and now it became 0, meaning that he has a molecular response. There's no tumor DNA in his blood. That signaled to us that maybe we should proceed with perioperative assessment. He underwent a cystoscopy and also imaging, and there was no visible tumor, and meaning that he was ready for surgery. For neuropathy, we prescribe him some gabapentin, we refer him for occupational therapy, and also endocrinology to optimize his diabetes. Unfortunately, neuropathy did not fully reverse, but at least stabilized to the point that he was able to work. He underwent surgery, and his pathology showed no cancer. He was able to return to work, and preserve his function, and I think this case specifically highlights how important it is to sometimes individualize our treatment and stop early versus pushing for cure. This patient was we were able to preserve his damage of the peripheral nerves, and he was able to continue normal activities.
Great. So this is, I think, a really important case, looking at a patient who got enfortumab vedotin and thinking about what kind of side effects they're going to get. And I think the issue of skin toxicity is really important, the issue of eye, hyperglycemia, peripheral neuropathy, rarely pneumonitis. I have questions actually both for Rita and for Christina. So Rita, so you presented a patient who got EVP and on cycle one, day 10, had skin toxicity. Both of these drugs cause skin toxicity. So how do you know which drug is causing the toxicity, and how do you counsel the patient?
The treatment, number one thing is the management will be similar for both. We use corticosteroids topically. And the EV, sometimes we see just a little bit different pattern of the skin rash. The immune checkpoint inhibitors, the rash more diffuse in my experience. And I noticed that with EV, the rash usually very early onset, and patient presented this widespread sometimes reaction and just a lot of pruritus related to it.
And just to follow on to that, actually, do you think it's okay to continue one drug, or do you have to stop both drugs? Example, in the adjuvant setting, can you just give the pembro alone, or do you have to, you know, stop both?
We typically pause both, especially in patients who already have excellent response, if we can reassess it with a ctDNA, for example, and it could signal to us that we can de-escalate therapy. And I think the big goal here is that we can do less but achieve even better outcome.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'll say one observation is that a lot of our patients we're seeing virtually. Like, I see the patients a lot of times on Zoom, and we don't see the rash. But when they go into the infusion center, it's our infusion nurses who are catching the rash. And I think that really empowers everyone in the audience to really, you know, look at these patients and try and understand what's happening to them. And I think on that note, I want to ask Christina, you know, you see a lot of patients who have ostomy, who have wounds after surgery. Do these therapies impact the time that they're in the OR, the time that they're recovering? And then what do you see after surgery when they're coming in for their ostomy care?
That is a huge question. Yes, so I think even as Rita's patient had only two cycles, these patients are basically going now for upfront cystectomy. And in my post-op visit, I think there's more and more chemo or immunotherapy-related complications or side effects that are coming up that are permanent. I would say neuropathy is number one, that people are really struggling addressing neuropathy, and my hands are tied because tends to be permanent. What I want to bring your attention to is that if your patient has had radical cystectomy and they have an ileal conduit, and a lot of these folks end up having colitis or other type of skin issues, for these surgeries, we are utilizing segment of the small bowel. So once your colitis is causing systemic inflammation or GI inflammation, your stoma will have issues at the top of their abdomen. One key issue is with this is that the rule of thumb, if you have a lesion and an ulcer on a peristomal skin, let's say it took a month to get there, it's going to take us 3 months to fix it. So if your patient says that, oh my God, my appliance doesn't fit correctly, something's painful underneath, that flange needs to come up and somebody needs to assess that skin. Ulcerations are extremely common, becoming more and more common. Oftentimes they come on very quickly and unexpectedly, and they become very big and very scary looking for folks. And these people need to be seen immediately either by dermatology or by wound and ostomy so we can take care of it. Usually it doesn't require anything major or surgically involved, but cleansing properly, usually with water and vinegar, and then applying some kind of a silver alginate to actually heal the ulcer, and then taking off convexity. Most people have minimal understanding how convexity can affect these ulcers, so generally we want to have minimal pressure on the skin until this heals.
Okay, and do you hold the EV if they're having ulcers, or do you sort of make that
then I call Terry and ask her what to do. I'm not sure.
But again, this is just highlighting the importance of close physical exam with these patients, because a lot of times they won't report it, they won't notice it. Bladder cancer is a disease of the elderly. You know, the average age is about 60 or 70. Some of our patients are in their 80s, and they may not notice things that I think we'll notice in the infusion center or in the clinic. So. Do you want to add anything? No? Okay. So let me move on, also in the interest of time. We're going to switch gears now. It's sort of funny, we've been talking about muscle invasive disease, patients going to surgery. We're actually going to step back and go back to the non-muscle invasive space. This is actually the most common presentation of bladder cancer. It's about 50,000 cases a year. And what I'm going to do is talk about using these immune checkpoint inhibitors in non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. So as we've heard already today, BCG is the standard of care. This is a picture of BCG. It's a bacteria, a tuberculous-like bacteria that's given into the bladder. And you can see that in the diagram. The challenge here is this is looking at recurrence rates from the time of getting BCG, and what you can see is only about 50% of patients are rendered cured of bladder cancer by getting BCG. So it works well, but not for everybody. And we need better therapies for these patients because you've heard they need to get their bladder removed. That's considered the standard treatment, and that's a big deal. And actually, if we think about it conceptually, why add immune therapy? Well, actually, if you give BCG, the cancer cells upregulate PD-L1 on their surface. It's like a shield to fight the BCG and fight the immune cells that are trying to attack them. And the idea of giving therapy is you're going to rip that shield away. And then clinically, it makes sense. You may be able to avoid cystectomy, obviously, because you're giving two therapies together. And the PD-1 therapy is a systemic therapy. So if they have micrometastatic disease, if they have disease outside the bladder that you can't see, you're kind of giving them like a two-pronged approach. So that's kind of the basis for doing these trials. And as I mentioned, and I think you've heard already to this evening, avoiding cystectomy is a major goal for patients. It's the most morbid procedure, in my opinion, that we do in urologic cancers. And while it cures patients, it's a major life change, both physically, cosmetically, emotionally, spiritually. So, most patients want to avoid it if they can. And so I think there's a rationale to try and do that. So there are two studies here. They're called CREST and POTOMAC. You can see the names on the left. They're in green, just like Dr. Jakaki pointed out. And what these studies looked at were patients who had already had BCG and had recurrent disease in the bladder, but they didn't have metastatic disease or even muscle invasive. And what they did was they got, in the treatment arm, they got a PD-1 inhibitor plus BCG. These studies were in BCG-naive patients. I misspoke there. They got BCG plus a PD-1 inhibitor, so either sasanlimab, which is a subcutaneous PD-1 inhibitor, or durvalumab, which we've heard a little bit about today, and that was compared to getting just BCG alone. There was a middle arm here where patients got BCG induction, but they didn't get maintenance. I'm not going to talk about that. It was really looking at standard BCG plus minus a PD-1 inhibitor, so actually a fairly straightforward design. In the study, you can see there were slight differences. Both groups got 2 years of BCG. The amount of PD-1 was slightly different between the two studies. But interestingly, the outcome, the data was almost identical. And what you can see is that the groups that got a PD-1 inhibitor did better than the group that didn't. The absolute difference in recurrence was about 7 or 8% between the two arms. And that was considered positive. That's what the studies were aiming for. So there is a difference. It's not dramatic, but it is saving some people from having cancer relapse after getting BCG in the front line. The overall survival was looked at. It's not mature, so we don't really know if giving a PD-1 early actually prolongs people's lives. We're going to have to wait for follow-up of these studies to understand that better. If you look at the treatment-related adverse events, that's the very bottom line here, it's about 20 to 30% of patients had some sort of side effect from the PD-1 inhibitor, which is consistent with prior studies, but is real toxicity, right? And the question is, do they need that toxicity, if there's only a marginal benefit? So putting this together, I think adding these PD-1 inhibitors to frontline BCG, that may become an option for patients with high-risk disease who first present to the clinic. The benefit, I didn't really show this to you, but was mostly in the T1 patients with the highest risk patients. And there's a separate study of pembrolizumab, the Keynote 676 study, that's going to be reported soon. So not yet an option, but if you see these patients, this might become an option soon. As we think about it, though, I don't know if the autoimmune side effects are worth it. We just heard from Rita about serious autoimmune toxicity. So how do we balance sort of this event-free survival benefit, so less relapses, Overall survival, which is not yet mature, we don't know if patients are living longer, and toxicity, which is real. I think it will allow some patients to avoid cystectomy, but there are other therapies available. And the other question is, who's going to give these therapies? Is it going to be medical oncology? Most of these patients are just seen by urologists, by Christina and colleagues. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of education that's needed. And if you're a urology nurse, I think you're going to have to really learn. I'm glad you're here. You're going to have to really learn how to use these agents. The big question is, can we just save the PD-1 inhibitor for patients who've gotten BCG and who have relapsed? And the answer is maybe. The KEYNOTE 057 study, this is a complicated schema. It's a super straightforward study. Basically, they gave everybody pembrolizumab and saw what happened. Again, these were patients who had BCG unresponsive disease. And what we see is that about 20 to 40% of patients have good long-term outcomes. I personally have like an 83-year-old man who got pembrolizumab for BCG refractory disease 6 years ago. And I still see him. I don't really know why, because I think he's just cured. But he's super happy. He kept his bladder. You know, at 83, who wants to do a surgery like that? So I think we really did help him. He fortunately didn't have a lot of autoimmune toxicity, but you've just heard about patients with serious autoimmune toxicity. So we have to be really careful about selecting these patients and then obviously monitoring them. So this is an option. What the good news is that we have a lot of other, and I should say this is FDA approved, we have a lot of therapies coming. And honestly, we'd have to do a whole second session just to focus on these. I'm going to talk in just a second about one of them. But if you just look at the categories here, we have chemotherapy, we have viral therapy, nadofaragene firadenovec is a virus, a genetically engineered one that you can give into the bladder, kind of like BCG. We have other immunotherapies, so NAI is an IL-15 agonist that's given with BCG. I just told you about PD-1 inhibitors as well. So there's a lot of different qualitative things we can do to give into the bladder that can help. And there's more in the pipeline. I'm not even showing you what's in study. These are all already approved for BCG-resistant disease. So that's pretty exciting. I think in the interest of time, I'm actually going to skip the case presentation because I think the discussion is more interesting or more important. So the question, I think this is for the group, is when patients with NMIBC present to care, is there an ideal candidate for this? And I guess, Christina, you see these patients right on day one. How do you think about this study, and are you comfortable using these agents? Would you want a medical oncologist or someone like, Dr. Trakaki or Rita involved?
Oh, absolutely. 100%, yes. I think we are in murky waters a little bit. We had, I feel like, a very clear pathway up until recently, and we are in this bloom of all these new therapies, which is wonderful, but we are learning along the way, both providers, nurses, physicians, surgeons. So I do think it's a highly collaborative process. I also think, given whether somebody, let's say, failed BCG and how many additional therapies they really want to undergo with a raw bladder, with the UTIs, with the dysuria, just coming in, 2 hours at a time and then having symptoms throughout the weekend. And as we know, a lot of these therapies are additive for intravesical treatment. So you kind of fly through your induction with BCG times 6, and then when we start cycle, 7, 8, 9, et cetera, the further we go, the worse it gets. So I think it's a combination of age, functional status, and goals. Because at the end of the day, it's about quality of life, right? And many patients really want to undergo a cystectomy. We do have a very strict pre-operative pathway so that there are no surprises from the nursing or APP end. Like if you undergo that surgery, you know exactly what's coming at you. But I think more and more people will be potentially electing bladder-saving treatments. I think one caveat is upstaging, because there's potentially cancer progression, right? And so when you choose your second or third line intravesical treatment, we go from high-grade T1, and then all of a sudden, not only we have T2 disease, but now we have a positive lymph node. And we've unfortunately seen this a handful of times in the past year with significant upstaging, and then now we have to give adjuvant treatment on the back end.
Right. So there's sort of rationales both ways to give PD-1 earlier to try and just prevent them from ever relapsing. but also risk of side effects,
and then
multiple other lines. Yeah. And I guess, Rita, like, I don't know if you've seen these patients with non-muscle invasive disease, but how would you counsel them? Is there anything you would tell them, especially for everyone in the audience from a nursing perspective, like what is important for folks to know if they're going to use a PD-1?
This is definitely very challenging. I just saw a new patient yesterday who came to our clinic. He was in his 80s. He's a primary caregiver of his wife. And he has very aggressive histology of his... We don't know if he has muscle invasive or not. Based on TURBT, he does not, but MRI shows us that potentially he does, and he wants to avoid surgery at any cost. Unfortunately, BCG failed, and we were talking about even giving upfront potentially EV and pembrolizumab and then doing consolidative radiation therapy later on, just because we're still trying to figure out the best way to manage the patient. And trimodal therapy is very important, bladder sparing options, and also individualizing treatment and care based on our patient's needs, and also based on all advances and side effect profile that they have.
Yeah, so I'm hearing a lot about tailoring therapy, understanding what's important to the patient, thinking about comorbidities, because now we suddenly have all these options and there may not be just a one size fits all for all of our patients. And I think that's where everyone in the audience comes in, is really getting to what's important to the patient, relaying that to the medical team, and thinking holistically about the patient. So, okay, I think in the interest of time, I'm going to move on to module 4 here. So I'm also going to talk about now the novel therapies. I sort of mentioned this just in the last slide, so I'm showing it again. And the therapy I'm going to focus on here, because we only have really a few minutes, is actually a novel way to give chemotherapy into the bladder. And that's what's called this gemcitabine intravesical system. Before I get there, I do want to point out that 5, I think, of these boxes are chemotherapy. And while chemotherapy almost feels a little passé now, we're talking about, you know, antibody drug conjugate, we're talking about immunotherapy and all viral therapies, chemotherapy still has a very important role in the management of bladder cancer. And as you can see, there's sort of standard chemotherapies, gemcitabine, docetaxel. You can use mitomycin C. You can use other single agents like gemcitabine alone. But I think there's some challenges with chemotherapy when we give it. And this is all into the bladder. I should be very clear. This is not systemic chemo. This is chemo you're going to give through a catheter in the infusion center. And I think there's some pros and cons to chemotherapy. The pros are you're actually giving chemotherapy right to the cancer. Like, we rarely do that in oncology, where you're physically putting chemotherapy on the cancer. You can get a high concentration in the urine. It's fairly well tolerated. I think Christina could tell us more about that. There's years of safety and efficacy from this, and the cost is actually very cheap. Of all these therapies, this is by far the cheapest. Mm-hmm. The challenge is that, you know, the patient's only in the infusion center for like an hour. You put the therapy in, you close the Foley off, they're sort of bathing the bladder, and then you're pulling it all out, and you're like, come back in 3 weeks. What happens in those 3 weeks is the tumor starts growing again. Even during that 1 hour, if they're drinking lots of fluids, you know, the chemotherapy is going to get diluted just by the natural urine in the bladder. It's a lot of catheterizations, and you know, I think the cystitis and just inflammation can be a real problem. And then it's also not that effective. I'm not showing you all the data, but it doesn't really cure people. Maybe it prolongs the time to cystectomy. So that sort of left an opening for this new treatment, this gemcitabine intravesical delivery device, also called TAR-200, sometimes referred to as the pretzel, as everyone can probably see on the screen. And so this is pretty interesting, because this is a sort of essentially a bio, sort of a plastic device that's filled, as you can see on the top, with a solid core of gemcitabine chemotherapy. So the chemotherapy is actually not that novel. It's just gemcitabine that's been around for 30 years. But it's allowed to sort of slowly leak out through the device into the urine. And what happens is this is linear. It's given through a catheter, and it automatically curls into this pretzel shape inside the bladder, and that keeps it in the bladder. So they can't urinate it out. It can't go up the ureters. It just floats in the urine. It gives continuous release of this. There's almost no systemic exposure, so they don't see any gemcitabine in the blood. Mm-hmm. You know, you can give this once every 3 weeks, so it's like less office visits, and you may even be able to give it for longer. Pretty well tolerated, and the big question is this better than giving gemcitabine, for example, once every 3 weeks? And so there was a very large study done called the SunRISE-1 study. So this was a multi-arm study, and I'm really just going to focus on the arm that gave this as monotherapy. This happened to be in a cohort of patients with carcinoma in situ as their non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. That's not so important, but really what's important is to see what happened when they give this in the bladder. And what they saw was 82.4% CR rate. So almost everybody's cancer disappeared at the very first assessment with this. So clearly very effective at knocking back the cancer. And then if you look on the right side of the screen, when you looked out a year later, so 12 months, 45% of patients still had not had any recurrence of cancer in the bladder. And that's pretty good. And if you got to 24 months, it's actually pretty good as well. So 2 years later, very few problems with this. Most patients responded quickly, and like at the very first assessment after getting this system, this gemcitabine system. And when you look at the responses, some of these responses are really durable. You can see it at 24 months for the patients who started responding, half of them are still responding to this gemcitabine therapy. So that's like pretty good for relative to all of our other therapies. And so this, based on this, actually, the FDA approved this therapy. You can see the treatment-related adverse events overall are real. You know, 80% of patients have some side effect. There's very little problems inserting this into the bladder. Almost all the insertions were done very easily. And very few patients stopped the therapy because they were having serious problems, no deaths. You can see the serious side effects were rare, like a serious UTI in 1% of patients, urinary tract pain in, you know, just a handful of patients. So overall, pretty well tolerated. And based on this, as I mentioned, this got an FDA approval just very recently and now is an option for patients who have BCG refractory disease with CIS. Now, this was like a phase two, a multi-arm phase two trial. And actually, before I talk about where we're going, one of the questions that comes up is actually, why gemcitabine, right? Why not another agent? Are there other things we can put in there? And the answer is yes. So one of the really interesting things about bladder cancer is that there's a common mutation that's seen in a lot of bladder cancer in the gene called FGFR. These mutations occur in about 30 to 60% of these non-muscle invasive tumors. And there's a drug, erdafitinib, which some of you may have had patients on. It's an oral medicine. It is effective against these FGFR mutated bladder cancers, but it's fairly toxic. It can cause a lot of rash. It can cause problems with the kidney. It can cause other issues with phosphorus and other electrolytes. And so this was a phase one study in which they took patients who had FGFR mutated disease and put the erdafitinib into this delivery device. So it slowly leaked out into the bladder for patients who had FGFR mutated bladder cancer. And what I'm showing you here are called swimmer's plots. And they're basically each line is an individual patient. And in the red was the time they were on therapy. And it goes out to essentially until they recurred with disease. And what you can see is actually the data was decent for this. You know, some of these patients were getting a year or more of erdafitinib. And the nice thing was the amount of erdafitinib in their bloodstream was super low. They had very few side effects. It was very similar to what I just showed you with the TAR-200. So this is a study that's now underway. This is the MoonRISe-1 trial, which is looking at this and comparing it to older chemotherapy. So we'll see what the results of TAR, of what we call TAR-210, the erdafitinib-containing device, will be. So with that, I think I want to pose some questions again for our panelists about this therapy. And maybe I'm going to start with you, Christina, because this is really falls squarely in the urology side of urologic oncology. How are you using this? How are we at UCSF and elsewhere integrating this into care? Are you talking to people about this at the beginning? Are you waiting for them to relapse before you mention it?
Yeah, no, great question. UCSF is actually, we are in the process of getting this on the formulary, quote, which will be a minute. But we do have now currently four patients who are not trial patients, but patients who have failed BCG or had relapsed high-grade T1 disease who absolutely wanted bladder preservation. So currently, these are installed in clinic during cystoscopy, and actually my next segment will be talking about that. We are currently ordering kits literally one at a time, and if that's happening at UCSF, I can imagine it's happening on your side of the world also in clinic. So basically, if we know that somebody's going to come in for an insertion on a Thursday, we have to notify pharmacy on a Monday. They're going to deliver it on a Tuesday, hopefully not on a Wednesday. And it doesn't need refrigeration. It basically comes in a kit with a stylet for insertion. I think patients are really discussed and having a conversation with our team when BCG failure or recurrence has happened, and we are really talking about alternative regimens versus cystectomy. So definitely not upfront at this point.
But it's becoming an option. I know we have it in trial as well.
Yes,
we have
absolutely.
One of the subsequent studies. So Rita?
Yeah. I have a question for Christina or for Dr. Friedlander. How do you take it out?
Are you going to talk about that in your next talk?
I'm going to talk about
that. Okay. That's actually a great segue. Dr. Chaka, do you want to add anything to the... Do you have experience with TAR 200?
I mean, we're also trying to get it as a formulary.
You have it on a formulary?
We are working on that right now. You know, the conversation is the cost.
Yes, it's very
expensive.
And
how that will affect the clinics and the patients. And then the last piece, patients are asking, is it painful?
Mm-hmm. What's been your experience about pain? I mean, it was reported in the trial, but we've had, I think, three patients on have done pretty well.
Yeah. So insertion, I don't think it's painful. I think what we are learning is that within the first week or two, there are more side effects from the release of the medication. Usually by day 7, we are able to have some detectable gemcitabine levels in the urine. So you're basically dealing with very similar side effects as you were to be dealing with any intravesical therapy. I don't think it's significantly different. And we're also just learning along the way. And so whatever knowledge you have for managing intravesical treatments, like that's in your back pocket. That's your superpower as a nurse, to communicate that to your team, to your APPs, to your attending, you know, page, stop the infusion, not with the pretzel specifically, but we are basically figuring out the protocol one step at a time.
So this is in development. So come back next year and I think you'll hear even
We'll have
more.
A protocol for you.
So I think we're running short on time. We have 9 minutes left, or 8 minutes left. So I think we're going to turn it over back to you, Christina, to finish us off
and
talking about toxicity profiles and some of these therapies.
Look at my pretty bladder. All right. So we mentioned, thank you so much for the beautiful segment into TAR 200. Some of the insertions, removal, urinary issues, and systemic toxicities, and basically how are we managing this. Meet the pretzel, because all of us just call it the pretzel, and it's a very small device. Basically, as Terry said, it is a coming in a little stylet. In clinic, we are using a catheter. It's a straight line. We are inserting it into the bladder, like if you were a nurse and inserting a catheter. We prefer to have your bladder full. So once there is urine coming back, we know that we're in the right place. And also, there is a little plunger. So we basically use the plunger to push the device into the bladder. Upon touching urine, it basically curls into this pretzel shape. Currently, we are using this for patients who have BCG unresponsive cancer with carcinoma in situ. So from my first talk, we know that is a high-grade cancer with or without papillary tumors. So dosing is a lot more favorable for patients. So this is also when you're getting calls from your infusion center or your schedulers that the patient lives 3 hours away and they cannot come once a week for their BCG induction or maintenance. This is only given every 3 weeks, and 14 doses are given initially over 2 years. So inserted every 3 weeks, removed every 3 weeks for the first 6 months, so those are 8 doses total, and then after that it's only every 12 weeks for up to 18 months, so it's 6 doses. So when you're looking at the psychosocial issues of your patients, transportation, age, how are they going to get a ride? They are difficulty, you know, even walking with a walker, or you know, their son lives in another state. So these are really important considerations to see who else needs these treatments. So in this picture, as I mentioned before, one, the bladder full, inserting a catheter via the urethra, and then basically passing through the plunger, curls into a pretzel. The removal in 3 weeks, when the patients come in, we are basically using a cystoscope. At the end of your cystoscope, not only there's a little camera, there are little teeth that you can grab something with, so we basically pull it out. Now, the beauty of these insertions and removals also that the clinician has a chance to also kind of eyeball the bladder, and patients are very excited to see when their bladder doesn't look as angry and they feel good about it. So it's not an official cystoscopy, perhaps, but we are actually still looking at the bladder in between. So Terry actually mentioned some of these treatment-related side effects. I don't need to reiterate this, but I don't think the side effects are significantly different than what we have found in different intravesical treatments. I would say the bread and butter of nursing and any intravesical system, whether it's BCG or TAR 200, is your UA dip microscopy and your urine cultures. If you woke me up 2 in the morning and you say, Johnny has Klebsiella, in a zombie apocalypse, I can tell you what to treat it with. You know, like, you just need to know your cultures and what to treat your patients with. Now, one issue I think that comes up, and I think it will require more clinical knowledge, generally what kind of antibiotics we can use in these treatment modalities if your patient comes back with a positive leukesterase and nitrite. For BCG, we generally prefer to have patients on very specific therapies not to interrupt treatment modality or decrease efficacy of treatment. So I would say for now, I'm relying on that same knowledge that I would be treating these patients with usually Macrobid, maybe Keflex, but predominantly Augmentin as our treatment of choice. So some of the clinical management for these intravesical drug-releasing systems is really focusing on whether somebody has asymptomatic bacteriuria, which we honestly don't care about too much in urologic oncology. It just happens. Everybody has a badly behaving bladder. It's just part of the deal. UTI without a fever, we want your UA culture microscopy. We usually start you on empiric treatment, so this is when I'm going to tell my nurse, like, hey, can we call that Augmentin in for at least 3 days empirically? We are expecting some response within 72 hours. If they are responding, we finish culture, and then we keep the pathway going as planned for the three-week removal. If there is a fever, if there is a response, it's basically identical, all of these clinical scenarios. Now, if there's a fever that doesn't resolve, generally we will be removing the device. Or if patients have significant dysuria, and again, this is more common within the first week after placing the pretzel, then we will give the patient a break. So we will give it 2 weeks until the bladder recovers to move on. So this is an expert panel recommendation after the study came out. We currently do not have an official guideline. We had 17 urologists, medical oncologists, and scientists come together to come up with an algorithm, which is, again, very similar to how are we managing potentially dysuria in your patient with intravesical therapy.
So for the case, I would say let's try and do a bullet because we're almost out of time. So okay. If you can summarize.
So my bullet for Roy is that he's 83. He absolutely does not want cystectomy. He has failed BCG multiple times, and he was an excellent candidate for TAR 200. So high-grade T1 and basically absolutely discussed every different treatment modalities. We have finished the fourth insertion for Roy. And after the fourth, we gave him a break because he was having some dysurine issues. We have his whole schedule planned out with cystoscopies and insertions for the first 8. And I think this is, if you want to take away anything from this talk, this is it. How do you manage your dysuria? Because it's complicated. Hydration, hydration, hydration. Your patients need to be drinking at least 2 liters of fluids per day. If your patient's dehydrated, there's not a whole lot I can do. Most pain resolves within a week. You do want to have them on around-the-clock ibuprofen. I usually start them early on mirbetric and also potentially oxybutynin only as needed. Your alpha blockers are very helpful, so we are basically decreasing signaling for some of these alpha receptors to the bladder. We also use hydroxyzine. Timed voiding, avoiding your bladder irritants, the spicy, the chocolate, the citrus, etc. And I didn't put this on the slide, but one secret weapon that we can use is low-dose amitriptyline. So if patients are really not doing well with these instillations, talk to your providers, talk to your APP, talk to your nurse manager to loop in the right people, because we can manage these symptoms to get the patient through, because at the end of the day, that is the goal, to get them to the treatment.
Great. That is excellent. And I think excellent advice. I'm glad you have this right at the end to really seal it in. We have like less than a minute, but I was going to say, I mean, the question is really like, how is this tolerated relative to old school chemo? Because there's many folks in the audience who have given intravesical chemotherapy. Do you think this is very similar, or do you think it's better or worse?
I think tolerated excellent, but I only have four cycles in for a patient.
Right.
So I'll be back next year with more data in my head.
Excellent.
But I think for now, the side effects seem much better in the sense that removal and insertion is like 2 minutes, so you're not stuck in the infusion center with the two-hour BCG rolling into side to side, leaking and getting pages that I have BCG all over or whatnot. So I think this is a fantastic opportunity to utilize this, hopefully more.
Great.
Yeah.
So we're at time now. I wish we had more time. I hope we've illustrated just how much is going on in the urothelial space. We've only been talking about perioperative bladder cancer. There's a lot going on in the metastatic space, which unfortunately we don't have time to talk about, maybe next year. But I hope we've really illustrated kind of how exciting it is and how many new therapies there are and how much there is to learn. And I'm so glad everyone's here and online because there's so much data being generated and it's really gotta improve outcomes for all of our patients. So with that, we're going to wrap up. I want to say big thank you to our panelists and to everyone in the audience and online.